Welcome to Principles of Liberty number 25, where we continue our discussion with Glenn Stoll and reveal his interesting life.
Now, I met another fellow shortly after meeting Hartford Van Dyke. Actually, you know what? It wasn't 93 that I met Hartford. It was more closer to 1990, 91, somewhere in there.
That's what I would expect.
Yeah, it was.
Because I bet you in 92 when you were well-versed in all this stuff.
Yes. It was 1993 that I met Pastor Paul Revere of the Embassy of Heaven Church. That is when I then put the cap on it, shall I say, kind of put the whole thing together as far as pure church authority is concerned. Because Pastor Paul Revere is a very much of a purist, separation of church and state, pure church jurisdiction, total separation from the world. And he taught me many things along those lines, and seeing what he had been doing for the previous 20 years to that, I think it was, 10, 20 years, something like that, prior to that. And I really appreciated the things that he had been doing and the things that he shared with me. He first discovered that record keeping was very important. He discovered that from the Quakers, Society of Friends. It was the Quakers that had established their organization based upon keeping their own records. Birth records, death records, marriage records, all manner of records, anything they had, membership records, whatever they did, they kept records on it. And they issued certificates certifying the validity and the original legitimacy of their records.
With witnesses, etc., and all the proper...
Yeah. Good. That is correct. And one of the ways Pastor Revere discovered that was also when he was having problems in the secular courts in opposition to separation of church and state, where the secular government was trying to control the church. And what they told him was they started actually driving. Some people don't like that term because it's commercial. They say operating your automobile on the public right-of-way. But in the common vernacular, it's driving the car out on the road, you know. but in legal terms, it's operating your automobile on the public right-of-way for pleasure and for purposes of furthering the kingdom or doing what God has called you to do, not for state-regulatable commercial purposes. You see, state-regulatable commercial purposes requires a license for pleasure or for doing what God has called us to do.
I need to explain something to you for those who are new to these concepts. We're talking about the traffic law, the motor vehicle code, which is actually a subset of the Uniform Commercial Code. It is commercial law. So there's a whole trick going on that people who are in the know about, where the state is using commercial law and applying it to non-commercial activities, such as traveling on the public right-of-way. And there's many special legal meanings to words that the normal meanings to words are different. So when we talk about these things, we're trying to distinguish between the legal definition of a word and the normal definition of a word. So if you're getting a little confused here about what we're talking about, you have to get your Black's Law Dictionary or another good law dictionary and look up some of these words. And some of them you have to go to older dictionaries to find. But that's what we're talking about here, and I want to clarify that for you.
Now, there's another authority.
And actually taking pleasure in God is one of his
benefits to his people.
Enjoy him forever.
Absolutely.
Is part of doing what he wants. So
I will give you the desires of your heart, he says.
Right.
But of course, he does that by causing our desires to be in conformity with his will. So what Pastor Revere had discovered and began doing, and I met him some years after he'd been doing this, and I was so excited. When I saw what he was doing, I said, this is exactly what we need. This is the answer. Because I saw a long, long road ahead of us. I haven't even begun to touch on the abuses and the grievances that we had and how they were totally flaunted at every turn. And I'm not going to. I'll just give you one more
example.
Well,
that's really the key thing I'm trying to get for here for my purposes. But
okay, well,
because understanding the amount of abuse you went through is what makes you a unique witness to this whole situation.
Well, I'm talking, though, about in family court.
Right.
Let's get into some of those other areas.
Okay.
But as far as family court is concerned, let me just tell you one thing. And this is what finally cinched it for me. and finally realizing this is out of control. That we are never going to get on top of this thing. No matter how hard we work, no matter how long it takes, it's just never going to happen because they won't let it happen. Mm-hmm. And it was this. We had an issue in family court where we were suffering the abuse at the hands of the court commissioners and the system as it is. And we thought, we have got a case that we're going to win in appeals court because they are clearly in violation of the established law and the court rules. And they know it, and they're doing it anyway, and because they have a predetermined agenda. The only purpose for the hearings and the trials are to formalize what they've already decided is going to happen. Mm-hmm. They make up their minds way ahead of time. They have a predetermined agenda, and you simply have your hearings and your court matters in order to
legitimize their view.
Right, to justify why you're doing what you've already decided you're going to do.
Right.
And so, of course, we were objecting to this. And, without going into all the minute details and the legal issues as to what was going on, we brought it to the Court of Appeals. We lost at appeals, even though we had to win. We knew we were going to win. Hmm. Here's why we lost. And here's what they said. And it was published. Family Defense League was the plaintiff the appellant in this matter. And the appeals courts of the state of Washington said this: the courts make the rules, the courts can change the rules anytime they see fit. I liken it to a poker game. You go to somebody's house to play poker, and he announces the house rules before you start. And the house rules are, before we start dealing, is the house always wins. And the first rule is I make the rules. The second rule is I always win. Mm-hmm. Third rule is if I even start to lose, then we change the rules again to where I always win. There is no come let us reason together. There is no trying to find the truth and to do the right thing and fairness and equity and justice and fair treatment and all. It just doesn't exist. We have an agenda. The agenda is a secular humanist agenda that destroys the biblical foundation of the family. And there's so many other things.
So this would seem to point to some kind of conspiracy where evil people are getting into this system and building this system as it is. I mean, I don't know if I want to get off on that tangent of the history of how we got to this state, because I assume that at least the founding of the country, things were a little different. And that the court system was an effort to find the truth. At least I hope it was at some point.
Well, let's get to that conspiracy. Mm-hmm. The conspiracy is mostly, I believe, orchestrated by the devil. Mm. I believe it's a spiritual thing. It's mm-hmm. a spiritual battle, spiritual warfare. But in the tangible terms, the conspiracy has very much to do with the court system and the way it operates today. And what you just said about the founding mm-hmm. of the American system of government was not at all the way it operates today. It was, as a matter of fact, it was set up to defend us and to protect us against the types of abuses we're suffering at the hands of the jurists and attorneys right. and so forth today in this
system. So it has been turned 180 degrees, and that's a whole volume of information to learn that history.
It is, but I think maybe I can give you a brief overview
quickly,
so that
great.
We can.
That'd
but
be great.
Like you said, though, we could spend hours and just on that subject alone.
But understanding that is a crucial thing for people to even believe this. Most people who've never been to court and never had to fight anything, especially against the system where they're, like a situation yours where the cards are stacked against them and they're trying to do something that's against the agenda of the system, very few people have that experience. And so they were raised in their public schools and they're fed by their public entertainment on the TV, and they have no clue what's going on. They're watching divorce court, or what's the one? Who's that judge?
Oh yeah, those judge shows.
Judge
There's
Genie
a lot of
whatever,
them. There's a whole bunch of them. Yeah.
And they think that's real life, or they think Law and Order is real life. My wife loves to watch Law and Order, and every time I look at it, I just about puke because I'm like, that is not the way it works. It's not even. These people are anyway. So I'll let you go ahead. If you can give us a brief history, that'd be great.
Well, it starts with probably the most well-known phrase in American documents. And that is the one that says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we see all these other things then that were established, 11 years later with the Constitution, and then some years later with the Bill of Rights, and how all of these things were set up and instituted in order to protect people from abuses as we see them today. All of those people that wrote those documents that I mentioned and other things accordingly, most of them were lawyers. Most of them were lawyers. Not one of them was an attorney. Not one. As a matter of fact, the reason they wrote the things they did the way they did was to protect the people from the abuses of atonement. You say, well, what in the world? Atonement, what is that? They're lawyers but not attorneys? I thought it was the same thing. Most people do. Not at all. Every attorney is a lawyer, but not every lawyer is an attorney. I have been practicing law since 1990, and I have never been an attorney. I aspired to become an attorney until I found out what it was all about and decided there is no way I would ever become an attorney. Attorney has its basis in the English feudal system. Have you ever received a letter from an attorney? You will see, usually, most attorneys fashion their return address and their address on their letterhead with the title Esquire.
Right.
ESQ period. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? That is a title of nobility established by the English feudal system. That was the purpose of the Esquire, who is the attorney, because they practice attonement. The process of the practice that they were doing was called attonement. The esquires would attorn. And to attorn, in simple terms, means to preside over the ceremony of transfer of property, to make sure that all property of any value or significance always was kept in the hands of the elitist ruling classes and never got into the hands of the common people. We know what's better for you. We can rule better than you. That form of government is called an oligarchy, where you have a class structure of nobility, the oligarchy system, where the elitists are much more intelligent and know what's best for you, and they will rule, make sure that you are taken care of the way they think you should be taken care of.
So they are the Praetorian Guard of the king's men for the king's property.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
You got it?
Yes.
To illustrate my point, I listened to a very interesting Paul Harvey broadcast. It was called The Vermin in the American Colonies. And Paul Harvey was telling his story, you know, like he does, explaining about in the American colonies prior to the Revolution, there was a vermin that was loose. And they were going about doing all kinds of damage and destruction and causing plagues, and it was just horrible to the community and the society around them. And it was devastating. This vermin, they called it. And his story goes on and on until he finally gets to the very end of the story. And he says, so who was this vermin? What is this vermin, he called it, that was doing all this damage to the American colonies? In his rest of the story, he said it was the lawyers. But in fact, it was the lawyers practicing law in that particular fashion of attonement under the English feudal system. It wasn't just the fact that they were lawyers, it was the fact that they were lawyers practicing attonement as esquires in that system, maintaining a class structure of nobility. The haves and the have-nots, the elitists versus the elites versus the elitors, I guess you call them. And you know, I'm always so concerned about division among us, whether it be division over race, division over gender, division over age, division over any kind of thing you can think of, educational abilities and things like this. We should not be fighting amongst ourselves and being divided over those things. We need to band together. Race, gender, age, whatever the issues are, disabilities and other things, and work together for a common cause, and that common cause is for individual freedoms and liberties, so that all of us can have the freedom to do what God has called us to do and follow our calling and our and follow the desires of our hearts, as long as they're moral, ethical, and legal, you see. And the problem is, though, that kind of interferes with the deal that they've got going in order to build an empire and build their wealth at the on the backs of the common people. This is why at the time of the American Revolution, they were bound and determined. They would not allow that vermin to step back in and to take over and to abuse the people. Like Benjamin Franklin said, he was asked, "Mr. Franklin, what sort of government have you given us after the establishment of the original, the first American government?" He said, "We have given you a republic, if you can keep it." Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't kept it. At all. I don't know how. It was very short-lived.
How long do you think it actually lived?
Well, it all depends, because it gradually started eroding.
Right.
And so where you can find the actual time where it no longer existed, I don't know. There are many different landmarks in that whole erosion period. Mm-hmm. One of the first landmarks was 11 years later with the United States Constitution, after they wrote the Declaration of Independence. The Constitution actually was in erosion, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. The reason, one of the reasons it
from
was
from the Articles of Confederation, you mean?
It was an erosion from the Articles of Confederation and from the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm.
So
and,
was,
and the
was,
reason, one of the main reasons it was, is because it did not contain the Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. But of course, then the Bill of Rights came later to repair that problem.
Right. Was Franklin referring then to the Articles of Confederation, or was he referring to the Constitution?
I believe he was referring to the Declaration of Independence.
Ah, okay.
And so as we go along from there, he said a republic. When people refer to the American form of government, what do they call it? They almost always call it a democracy.
Right.
You hardly ever, even by Republicans, mm-hmm. hear them call it a republic. Mm-hmm. It was originally intended to be a republic. A democratic form of republic, but a republic primarily. Mm-hmm. And the main mm-hmm. purpose of that was because the republic is to respect individual freedoms based upon an established constitution. Based upon, and that constitution was, the Articles of Confederation was a constitution. A constitution, when people talk about constitution, doesn't always necessarily mean that document that we refer to as the Constitution for the United States of America. Mm-hmm. But constitution is your core foundation upon which you build everything else. The core foundation upon which the U.S. Constitution was built was the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And it was done to replace the Articles of Confederation.
The first topic I covered on my podcast was the Pennsylvania Minority Report and what the Anti-Federalists were objecting to, the weaknesses in the Constitution. As soon as it was ratified, they were saying, you got these holes, and they listed like 20 things, which was the source of the Bill of Rights, but also had other things that the Bill of Rights did not cover. And one of those things was that the court system would not protect the poor, that it was a system designed that would eventually do nothing but the bidding for the rich.
Mm-hmm.
And that was perceived by them before, you know, right before the ink was dry on the Constitution.
Well, yes, that's very good. And you see what has happened, though, as it develops. Who was getting a stronghold in government? The attorneys, the lawyers practicing attorney.
Right.
And as they began doing this, it wasn't in the early 1800s, I think it was somewhere in 1820-something, that the final ratification of the original 13th Amendment was done. There was an original 13th Amendment prior to the one that people are familiar with today, mm-hmm. that was fully ratified and enacted into law as a part of the United States Constitution, and it abolished the attorneys, the vermin. It said they cannot hold office, they cannot even be citizens if they are practicing attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
Or had any title of nobility, such as esquire or honor. It even used the term honor.
Hmm.
So the right honorable, or the honorable, or your honor, none of those terms were allowed.
Now this was ratified, and yet I guess the Civil War caused the opportunity for it to somehow get lost.
That's because when Congress adjourns sine die, that means that's the Latin term for without setting a time for them to reconvene. They adjourned and never reconvened in 1861 when the Southern states walked out of Congress. And it was never never reconvened again.
Now, Lincoln wanted to get it reconvened, but he was shot before he could do that, is my understanding. And so we never really restored the Republic from that point. The division caused there not to be a quorum. You couldn't do any business. And then after the Civil War was the Reconstruction period, which is the most vague period of history in my mind because the schools never told me anything about it, and I've not seen much on it. But how is it that we totally lost the Republic and didn't even know it?
One of the problems was the Dred Scott decision. The Dred Scott decision was, I think, 1840-something. And it was a decision of an African-American liberated slave who was living in Missouri. And he had a dispute with someone. He wanted to bring a matter to court. And he was barred from bringing a matter to court because he was a man of color and he had no standing in law.
Right.
So they said, what is relevant is being able to hold others accountable and to be free to live your life according to the dictates of your heart between you and God.
Right.
You know, so what if you could never vote? You know, of course, people treasure that privilege of voting, and I respect that.
Uh-huh.
But it is not as all important as people seem to. You know, I mean, that case in point is this, what they call the supermajority, the superdelegates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the superdelegate. What is this superdelegate? Well, because you don't elect a president by popular vote. They don't even nominate someone to run for president, especially in the Democratic Party, by popular vote. They elect them by, well, we know what's best, and we will decide who's going to be president, because this is what the country needs, this is what the people need. Popular, you know, you always say, well, sometimes you get a president in here who also got the popular vote. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more often not. President, it doesn't matter who votes.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter who votes for what. It's the delegates, it's the Electoral College, it's some of these other things that eventually come in to play. And now we're talking about voting for people. What about voting for issues? When you vote for an issue, your voting is an agreement that you will go along with and agree with and abide by the outcome of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot, and I will not, and you shouldn't either, vote for something that is absolutely, that is absolute. See, this is a problem when there are no absolutes in our society. There are absolutes, you know, and among those absolutes, the right to travel.
Mm-hmm.
We have a right, an absolute right to travel that cannot be prohibited. How about a right of expatriation? What does that mean? The right of expatriation means the right to choose your form of government, to choose that which you will be held accountable to. You know, it doesn't mean the right to be a traitor to your country.
Mm-hmm.
Not by any means. It means the right to be a loyal patriarch of the country of your choice, not just because you were born into it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, also a well-established principle
the
of
right
American
to choose
government.
Citizenship, basically. You're saying the right to choose citizenship.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Talbot case of United States Supreme Court, 1795, where it said that the Supreme Court said that people have the right to choose. They said, we just fought a war over this issue, the Revolutionary War,
mm-hmm.
and they still hadn't completed it at that time they made this decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Frenchman who had at one time been a United States citizen, and he expatriated. Became a Frenchman, came back, had some legal dispute, and one of the challenges of the case was that they were claiming he was a United States citizen because he hadn't followed the procedure and gotten permission from the United States government to expatriate.
Ah.
And And they say he doesn't have to get permission.
So
the international law says the only thing you have to do is follow the requirements of the country you are expatriating into, not the one you're leaving.
Right.
The one you're leaving has nothing whatsoever to say about
it. The one you're going to has to accept you.
That is correct.
Now, something that seemed to be coming out when you were saying was, one was the idea that we have certain rights that are absolute, and nobody can say that you don't have those. And then in the next breath, we're talking about, but the judge said we had this right, or international law says we have this right. So my question is, how does a person identify an absolute right and prove that that is such?
I saw a banner hanging on a Unitarian church one day not too long ago, and it said, civil marriage is a civil right. And it's absolutely correct.
Right.
But a civil right is not a natural right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that quote that I gave from the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, of any color, of any race, of any creed,
mm-hmm.
and are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Unalienable rights and civil rights are not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Voting is a civil right.
Right.
A civil right means a privilege that is afforded you by virtue of your membership or participation or standing or special position that you are allowed to hold according to the rules of that particular form of government.
Right.
That's a civil right. It's only a privilege that is granted you because of those relationships. A natural right is that which is inherent. It's common.
Okay, so I'm asking, what's the litmus test for an inalienable right? Is the basis scripture? Is
probably
the basis
benefits
natural law? Is the basis on what you would be able to do if you were the only person on earth?
Benefits, privileges, and immunities.
Hmm.
If you receive a benefit, a privilege, or an immunity that can be given you and can be taken away from you depending on certain circumstances, that is a civil right.
Mm-hmm.
When they are simply the enjoyment of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, property.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me hit you with one modern confusion we have in our postmodern society, and that is, there's a couple, but one would be the right to have two people of the same sex get married.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your definition of marriage, typically, you know, the Christian definition is God made marriage, and that was inherent in the creation of Adam and Eve. He didn't make Adam and Steve, he made Adam and Eve, and that's why Adam and Steve couldn't get married, because there wasn't a Steve to marry. But and you can't procreate. That's a natural law argument for the fact that to say that a unnatural marriage is not a right. Where do we figure this out?
We need to define terms.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to define a term, and you most accurately define a term by history. The history of the term and the usage of that as it developed.
Mm-hmm.
And what it became based upon how it got there. Rather than just taking a rote dictionary definition that may or may not be very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to take that term and define it by history. And that would be, let's start with a term what we talked about earlier. You know, attorneys. You know, the history of that term, attorney and attorney. And developing that argument a little bit further before we get into this one.
Mm-hmm.
Is what happened to the attorneys because they began getting a foothold, even though they were finally banned. That's why they had to do that original 13th Amendment, because they were creeping in and into society and doing their damage.
Mm-hmm.
And so they established this. The Civil War had more than just to do with slavery. It had to do with states' rights. It had to do with independent freedoms and liberties and other things of that nature. It was used and abused by the attorneys, who, you know, oftentimes they get on both sides of the fight, you know, mm-hmm. so that they can get, again, as we said, get people to pit one another against each other so that they can keep them weak and they can keep in power. And eventually what happened as a result of the sign-a-day adjournment of Congress, where they never reconvened, they reconvened a Congress. But it was a Congress of a new form of government that reestablished most of the old form of government. And the absolute proof of that is the 13th Amendment.
Join us next time when Glenn Stoll continues his amazing story.